Hello, welcome to Universal Soul Love. This is Detective David Love.
And Dr. Lana Love.
Welcome to our show. So we're really excited to be here again today, once again, on Universal Soul Love. We've been really busy lately. I just got back from Costa Rica from doing an adventure series film, and I was in Florida. I think I spoke about this last week. And now we're back in Sydney, and we've just moved recently, actually yesterday, so we've been really busy around here. But very excited to be back on the show. And today we have our special guest, our good friend Jacqueline Boyd, with us today. She's an animal rights activist and just a good friend that we know locally. And we often talk about philosophy and spirituality and just lots of different topics.
So Jackie's just trying to get through now, but Jack has also been an animal, has been a vet assistant, and is studying law. And so we'll be talking a lot about civil rights, environmental advocacy, animal communication, and spirituality. So
get a whole mix of topics
right.
That we may go through today that I think will be really interesting. And so let's see where. So we'll wait for Jackie, and we'll just get started, and we'll start talking about just about getting along in life. I know we used to talk to Jackie a lot about intellectual processing and learning and education, and you know what really makes a person talented and skilled in life with life skills. Because I mean, we often talk about the public education system and how it really doesn't, I know for me, it never really prepared me for life. High school and college really had nothing to do with my career. And it really, while it was a good foundation, I never really used any of it. Even my law enforcement courses did very little in terms of what I did as a private investigator and just getting by in life and being successful at everything I tried to do. So I think that it's interesting how people develop living skills, life skills, in order to not just survive, but to thrive. I mean, it's interesting how people operate, how their minds operate.
Absolutely, yeah. And I mean, that resilience comes into that as well, resilience and emotional intelligence. I've often been very interested in the concept of emotional intelligence, which has come up about 10 or 15 years ago, and that emotional intelligence, as opposed to IQ, actual intelligence, is what really creates success in life. Emotional intelligence is, of course, not how well you can do an exam, but how well you can cope in difficult circumstances, whether you get overly stressed or whether you can brainstorm, whether you can be flexible, whether you're good at communicating with people. That's what really makes a difference.
Yeah, I love what you just said, because it really goes along with my spiritual warrior philosophy mentality. It's really all about resilience. It's about, I've seen so many people in life get knocked down off their horses and really never get back up. And what I mean by that is they get so traumatized that they're just unable to cope. And you have to sort of be able to keep going. It's, you know, it's funny how some people get knocked down and other people just, you know, they're not unable to cope, and they're unable to manage their lives, and they become broken. And there's so many degrees of functionality in life and how people operate, and how, you know, in terms of people being able to manage their lives well. And of course, I think we all have issues. I mean, we all have issues. We're all perfectly imperfect. We all deal with something. We've all
some
had.
Some people have more issues than others.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we have the thin skull doctrine in law. It's people take things differently. So,
and it's interesting. I'd like to say that the so-called successful people often have more issues than others, simply because they try more things. It's like you know, the old saying that millionaires and billionaires have had many more, you know, have been broke much more often than the average person, simply because they've tried more.
Yeah, didn't we see an interesting post by Lynn Rose recently that talked about mistakes, and it said it's not that you make the mistake that's so important, it's that you let go of the mistake, that you don't hang on to it, basically.
Or how you respond to the mistake.
Right.
In fact, I've recently came up with a, I guess, some interesting concept that success in life is not measured by success per se, but how successfully you deal with failures.
Yeah, I mean, you learn from them. They're not failures. It's a learning mistake. I mean, it's a learning process. It's a building process.
That's right. Absolutely.
I mean,
and I often wonder whether this is a life skill you can pick up, or whether people are sometimes just born with a very flexible brain. I like to believe that you can learn it, although I do think some people inherently are just more flexible and can deal with things better than others.
I think it's about the reflective process. It's about being able to look back and think about, you know, what you got, thinking about trying to get the insights from your experiences, it's like being the spectator or the observer and almost looking at yourself as an actor in a movie and stepping back from it and watching your past and sort of in your mind and looking at it and saying, this is what happened. And I'm not putting a connotation of good or bad on it. I'm just trying to see what I can get out of this so that I can do things. If I want to do things differently, I can, you can take the things that were good and,
that's a very, very good point. So what you're saying is the ability to have like an observer self, a mindfulness quality, so that you can actually think more clearly. In fact, I was recently talking to someone who had suffered a sexual assault, who during the sexual assault was able to think clearly about the best way out of the situation. Absolutely amazing resilience. Amazing ability to have an observer self present in her while she was in a very high stress situation. Because of that, she actually didn't get killed. Absolutely amazing. The ability to have an observer self within you and develop that.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of just really having clarity. It's about really trying to maintain your center, because we've seen people that they just can't maintain their center. They get thrown off balance when people verbally assault them and they get offended, and it really throws them off. And you can really hang on to that and hold a grudge, and it can turn into that monkey mind effect where you're preoccupied with what a person said. And it's oftentimes I've found it's never ever about when you're in an argument with a person, it's typically what you're arguing about with the person is often not what the person's arguing about with you. They often have other things going on in their mind, and it could be any number of things. It could be work or family. And so you're never actually going to win any kind of argument. You're never going to get your point across because they're not even hearing you. They're thinking about something totally different.
That's right. That's absolutely right. I often think that in school they should be putting so much more emphasis on developing emotional intelligence and on communication skills. It makes such a difference. You know, you can have someone who's very intelligent intellectually, but who is not able to get a sense of observing themselves making a judgment about whether what they're doing is the best possible thing to do in the circumstance. And it's just so important. Often in my therapy with people, especially with adolescents, what I will do to demonstrate this is to have two chairs. And I'll sit on one chair and then I'll sit on the other. When I sit on one chair, I say to my patients that this is you in the driving seat, you know. This is you in your brain, you know, doing everything and feeling that you are you. And then I go onto the other seat. On the other seat, you sit and you observe yourself. In the other seat, you are a very peaceful, serene observer, observing yourself and then coming up with other more flexible ways or other alternatives. And it's a very, when you're in that seat, you do not criticize yourself. It's a very kind, gentle observer. And that really centers people.
Lana, can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, Jack. Hey, it is Jackie. Welcome to Universal Soul Love.
Yeah. I've got to ask you, what about the people who just can't do that? They won't take their brain there no matter how much you try.
I don't know what to do. I think a brain transplant might be a good idea. I don't know. I really don't know.
It's like a brick wall, really is.
Yes. Well, I don't know. What do you think?
No idea.
I think a lot of people can learn. I think if they're, if we're talking about a child or an adolescent, I think that brain is more flexible. I think people tend to get more set in their ways. However, you know, humans are well known for their flexibility, their ability to learn. And I don't know what it is about some people that allows them to learn, even if they, you know, they've had a really bad habit for years. Other people don't. And you know what? I think maybe something to do with attitude.
Mm.
And, you know, some people are just so stubborn and angry that they refuse to change.
And, you know, with this particular person, he did have a bad upbringing, and sometimes he reverts to a child state. And there's a theory that if you have a trauma that happens in your growing up, you can freeze development at that age where the trauma happens, and they can't develop in that particular part from that age onwards.
Right. Well, that makes a lot of sense, doesn't it?
Yeah, so, especially when you see this child come out in a 50-year-old man sometimes.
Mm. Right, yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, having done a lot of therapy, I would always advocate that as well to help. I mean, therapy I see as being a sacred space for a person, sacred space dedicated just to them, where they can completely relax, be themselves, and form a trusting relationship with a therapist who will observe. They're like an observing self as well, observe feedback, and this is just a wonderful way for people to grow. And of course, it sort of mimics a normal childhood where parents will observe, hold, and reassure a child. An example of how important it is to have someone observing and then nurturing you is if a child sort of falls down, grazes the knee and cries, a mother will usually, wrap her arms around the child, reassure the child, and then look the child in their eyes. Very often a parent will actually look pained, so reflecting the child's pain. And then the child will see their own pain reflected in another person's eyes, which allows them to see themselves from an observer self. Very important. And then, of course, the mother will sort of reassure the child after that it's okay, that you can cope with that. We'll help, you know, help them with their cut, put a Band-Aid on, and that gives the child the message that you actually can cope with things. The child then almost absorbs that kind parent into themselves, so that later on in life, when something happens, they have that memory and they can actually do that for themselves, observe and nurture themselves.
Right, I see. And the observation, that's a very good point, because that's the part that's missing.
Yes, the observation and, of course, also the caring, nurturing.
Yes.
When you've had the experience of being cared for and nurtured for, you're much more able to do that to yourself.
Mm. Many of us haven't.
I've got to say that the security is a good point that you bring up, because that's what a child needs, is security of that nature. I read another article and it said that sometimes when a child is rejected by a parent or not loved, which is seen as rejection, they go into a state where they believe they're perfect. They have to be perfect, otherwise they're not worthy of love. And that's how a lot of denial can happen with not learning from mistakes or anything like that, because they can't break free of this need to feel or believe that they are themselves perfect.
Mm.
I think I wrote about one of my books about, and I think this should almost be a diagnosis in the DSM-5 manual about perfectionism, because there's perfectionism that can be really useful to you in life, and then there's this sort of maladaptive perfectionist attitude that becomes sort of obsessive and compulsive, that's really dysfunctional.
So. Yes. Well, a lot of people have
that any sort of perfectionism is actually useful, is it? I mean,
I don't know. There's degrees of everything. We're on a continuum.
They say that if you're not loved enough as a child, you can work so hard towards impressing your parents that you become famous. A lot of people are famous because of trauma in the childhood.
Yeah, well, that's a very good point. And look, a lot of famous people are not happy.
Mm.
Oh, but yeah.
It makes you ambitious, motivated, and driven to some extent to really be you know, to have that attitude of I'm going to get this done and I'm going to get it done right. I don't know. Like I say, there's degrees and levels to everything we do in life. And I don't know. I've been studying human behavior for a long time, just like you have, Lana. And it's people really are really fascinating. And Jackie, I think you're one of the most interesting people I've met because we've had such interesting conversations with you about so many things. And this being one of them, just about learning.
Yeah.
So
thanks.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
Jackie, if you don't mind, we'd like to sort of almost pick your brain. Because I must say to I know that you're wanting to write a book, and I know that, Jackie, you've got an amazing brain, especially I think in the area of problem solving, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, but also I guess you'd probably call yourself a divergent thinker.
Like me?
No, I'd call myself severely ADD and dyslexic to begin with. And whatever the computer says is what the computer says, really, because I don't like to go around thinking I'm smarter or anything like that, because I'm not. I think we've all got different levels, and I think that the ADD and dyslexia that I have really gets in on that. But little bits of it come out. Just like I was telling you a while ago, I can solve a problem for NASA and then watch them spend $1 million figuring out what came to my head immediately, things like that. Oh, yeah. Mm. It's just, how should I put this? It's more of an intuition. So my IQ is only 140 something. So
only. Oh, my goodness.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, but we're differentiating between, like,
I mean, normal IQ is 100. But so we're talking about quite a few points.
But that's like intellectual processing and analytical processing and reasoning. Yeah. Opposed to awareness and higher senses and intuition, which is another, and emotional intelligence and moral intelligence.
But you're also very aware, aren't you? You are also an animal whisperer, aren't you?
Yes. I'm an animal psychic.
Animal psychic.
Right.
So I learned how to do that. I wasn't born that way.
Right.
People were born that way, but I was taught how, and I tapped into that area of my brain, and I did a reading.
So I would count that as another type of intelligence. You know, you've got IQ.
That's higher intelligence. That's higher intuition or higher senses. Mm.
But going back to the whole ADD thing, that the reason I said divergent thinker is that my understanding is that in quite a few parts in America, they actually start referring to that type of brain as divergent thinking, and the whole ADD spectrum as actually being perhaps a great advantage in many, many areas.
Oh, it is. It is.
Mm. If I can just clarify, divergent thinking, there's linear thinking. Linear thinking is your sort of
analytical, logical.
Yeah, you sort of accountancy, mathematics, you know, just
systematic.
Very clear. 1 + 1 = 2. Mm. And, you know, and many people are like that and can function very well in that world, but perhaps cannot maybe think of creative solutions. Now, divergent thinkers are non-linear. That means that the answer to something might be, you might have 10 different answers.
Hmm.
They think outside the box. And if you like, if you imagine, you know, a lined piece of paper, that's linear thinking. Yeah. If you imagine a blank piece of paper and then perhaps even, you know, drawing things or mind maps on that paper that go in many different directions, that's more like divergent thinking.
So what about me?
Very I sort well of
think both ways, and it's in a thinking sense. I mean, I'm very practical as a private investigator, you know, deductive reasoning, and yet I know there's so many other solutions outside of the box. You know, there's a multi-strategy approach
to
everything.
Well, I think you have two different states of mind. I think in one state you're practical and concrete and down to earth, and then I think you can tap into a different brain pattern, which is divergent.
Right.
What do you think of that, Jackie? Absolutely.
I think you've hit the nail on the head with that one. And, you know, Dr. Montessori, who came up with the Montessori schools, she was a medical doctor, not a teacher, but she saw this problem and she fixed it. But, of course, we don't use her schooling system for some reason, some silly reason. She said there's no such thing as ADD. And she's right, because she observed a child focusing on something that he picked up off the ground for ages, and that child had ADD. I solved a Rubik's Cube when I was 9. And I had ADD, so I can't focus or concentrate in the classroom. But put me in a situation where I want to do something and the ADD doesn't exist. So is there such a thing?
Well, hang on. Can I just take you up on that? I mean, you know, maybe what we need to do is break things down a little bit more. ADD is a huge term. I mean, I have, you know, obviously, I mean, I have a special interest with that in my practice with children and adolescents and grown-ups. And, you know, some people, for instance, have auditory processing problems. What that means is their brain, you know, even though they're just as intelligent, they have problems when they hear things. They can hear properly, but they have difficulty making, or it takes them longer to put to understand what was said. Having put that together, then they can very well come up with a very intelligent answer. It's almost like the brain, the neurons, the highway is a bit jammed, and it just doesn't work as quick. With stimulants, that can become much quicker. So it may just be, and these same people may be able to read a book very quickly. So I think sometimes it helps to be a bit more specific. And obviously thinking about the way to solve a problem, it's brain processes. It's very different to concentrating on someone talking and making sense of that.
I think half the people in our network have ADD, and many of them are entrepreneurs, and many of them are very well known and successful in many different areas of the human endeavor. If you don't mind me saying,
for some reason, seems to be an association between that and these amazing things.
Yeah, and I mean, go ahead.
Sorry, go on.
Yep.
Oh, you want me to go on? Because I was interrupting.
Yes.
No. Okay, there is an association. People who don't do well at school do well in life, because school isn't about life preparation. It's not about you need talent and you need ability to get past in life. And if you don't have those things, then you need a degree, put it that way. Obviously, if you have talent and you get a degree, you'll be good at what you do. But there are bad doctors and there are great doctors. There are bad lawyers, there are great lawyers. So the education system basically teaches a non-creative, very boring, awful, talentless system of education, and then you get out in the real world, and if you got A's at university and did really well at learning, it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to do any well in the real world. And the people who do well are the people who do badly. Einstein was asked to leave physics, and when he got an award, it was his teacher who told him to leave, who had to hand it to him. Winston Churchill's another ADD person. Richard Branson has ADD. These people didn't do well at school, but they did great in their lives.
There are people with ADD that have, you know, often have learning disorders and don't do well in life. So I think it so much depends on the individual. But what I have noticed is that people that tend to perhaps have some signs of, you know, not be able to concentrate, not have linear thinking, can be so creative in other ways. It's almost like the brain is wired up for not to respond to set rules, to make up their own rules.
Everyone has their own path, and it's mapped out in our brains. And we all know what we want from our lives at a young age. And the type of brain wiring system that you need to do well in school is only just one type. And all these other types, if school was meant for these other types, then the other kids who are getting A's now would not do very well in school.
That's very true. I wonder whether people can actually learn this. Can I ask you about your brain? Because you said before that you've had some amazing, well, very interesting MRI results from
their brains. That's what it was.
On ECG. Okay.
Yes.
All right. Could you tell us a little bit about that and how that might throw or give us clues as to how it seems to me that your amazing ability is to problem solve, right?
Right, okay.
So I would have thought that your brain association areas would be the ones that would really be sparking off.
Oh, I don't know the brain like you do by any matter, so I can't tell you what on that level. All I can tell you about is lines. And on my reading, there was a different sections, and each section had a little hill, like the pin graph of a lie detector machine. You know how it goes up and down like that? Mine was a line that just went straight up on the computer screen, and they had no idea where it comes down. It's supposed to come down in the same little bracket. Sometimes there's four or five brackets, you see the line come down there. But it was straight line. Does it go to Pimble? Does it go past the Earth? Who knows? They said that this is what the scientific community believed that Einstein's brain would look like on a ECG had the ECG been around at that time, because it just couldn't possibly look any higher than a straight line going up, because you just don't know how far it goes.
So, Jeff, let me get this right. ECG is, of course, electroencephalogram. So it's measuring the electrical pulses in the brain. So what you're saying is the electrics in your brain is just off the scale.
No, I don't understand how it works. But what they told me was that it's the reading that they get, and I don't think it's direct ECG like you're thinking. I know what you're thinking, and it's not looking at it live. It's what the computer program decides at the end of the day.
Okay.
I will have to. I have found the place where I had it done, and I will have to show it to you. This is what I was told. I was told you get a little graph, and mine was whooped straight up on the printout. So that's all I know. Sorry.
Now, but you know, Jackie. You know what I'm worrying. You know what I'm. What you know what just came to me now. What came to me now is it sounds like either your brain or your something is happening that is very different to other people. Now, we all assume, science assumes that our thinking is inside the brain, and in fact, the consciousness is inside the brain. Now, of course, metaphysical thinkers and spiritual thinkers have come up with something completely different. That is, the brain is just like a radio antenna.
Our
consciousness is way outside of the brain, in the sky, everywhere in the universe.
It's in us and without us.
ADD is a bad static radio channel. You need to turn the dial on the brain a little bit.
Okay, right. Yeah. So we're getting – so if the brain – if our consciousness and our mind might be outside the brain,
yes,
then that raises the question of whether our consciousness can actually fuse with others. Are you still there, Jackie?
Yes, I am.
The whole idea about Akashic records. So Akashic records are, I guess, defined as all the knowledge of the world.
To me, I call that the archives, but go on.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So really, because I was thinking, I had this sense that maybe one of the reasons why you're such a genius in this level is that you can tap into the archives. Am I right?
Absolutely. Yes.
We've talked about the higher self, Jackie, you know, as a higher awareness, as an able to tap into our higher
self. It's my ability to tap in, yes.
Downloads.
My ability to tap into that. Yes, downloads, yes. That's it.
So can you tell us about that? What does that feel like?
Oh, first time it happened, I was quite young. And when I say young, I mean 24. I had a whole lot of knowledge come down to me that I didn't want. And it was scary because I didn't know about Einstein's work. And when I learned about it, the same thing had come down to me, that I knew what he'd known. I'd already figured that out. Yes, quite a lot of it. And I haven't gone into everything that Einstein has to offer yet, because it did frighten me, really did, to have that happen. And it sort of made me wonder.
I was going to ask you, how old were you?
24.
And did you, like, you didn't actually feel Einstein's spirit, did you?
No. It wasn't like that at all. It was, I started to do a puzzle called the Riemann Hypothesis for fun, because I was in pain, and it helped to concentrate.
As one does.
And it felt like a gate had opened up, and the answers just snowballed. And I had this universal number system that could be put alongside the calendar. I don't have it now. Yeah. I got rid of it. Like, it's totally out of my head now. But I could predict things with it.
Wow.
Only on a short – I mean, I only had a tiny bit of what's there to grab, a tiny, tiny bit. And
did this happen after your accident?
Because the first year. It happened about a year after.
So, Andy, you had a near-death experience, didn't you, with the motorbike accident?
I did die, yes. I was dead for 3.5 minutes. So that's when I stopped counting, apparently. And that was three times, and the longest was over 3.5. So I was dead three times, yep.
So even though being brain dead is supposed to be, you know, having less oxygen to the brain, a lot of people get knocked off and are rather dumber afterwards. Do you think that actually opened your mind up?
I am terrified of brain injuries. I've been with people in rehab who have brain injuries, and I really question what's going on with their brain and what science actually understands. Because there was this man, I'll tell you, he was unresponsive completely. And every now and then he'd lift up his finger and point and go, "Ahoo," and point. And he'd do that three or four times during the middle of the night in the dead silence. He would hear this "Ahoo" quite loud through the halls through the day, and that's all he would do. And they said he wasn't there, he's brain dead, he's just gone. And I thought, no, his brain isn't working. He's still there, but he can't express to you that he's still there because he can't use his brain. His brain's broken. Drop a radio, you smash it, it's gone, right? But the consciousness is still there. They put his brain on an ECG or whatever it is. They see zero activity and they think, oh, well, he's not there. No, he can't use the radio. The radio's broken. That's all. I wondered if the reason he pointed and went, is because he had a car accident, a head-on, and he must have seen it coming. He pointed and went, and then when the impact happened, okay? And his brain had that happen the last time. That was the last message that the brain got before it got squashed. And his brain is repeating that last message of instruction that his consciousness gave to his body, point, and then that reaction. So I think his brain's just doing that because it's completely broken. And
Can I throw something into this? My little two cents on this. Now, we've talked about people with Alzheimer's like my dad had and dementia and mental retardation and profound mental illness and people who seem, you know, people who are almost nonverbal. These people, I know this from my higher self, that the human soul or the human spirit inside the body and outside the body, the consciousness is perfect and perfectly intelligent and perfectly capable of communicating with you if it were not for the brain and the body being damaged. And so when you see a person who's profoundly mentally retarded with odd behaviors, that doesn't represent the true person inside the body, the soul, or the consciousness.
Okay, I would have once agreed with you on that, except for one case. This fellow lost his inhibition, the part of the brain that inhibits you from running down the street naked, I guess your true self. But we are dependent entirely on the chemicals in our brain. This boy was hit by a car and he was 17 when he was out of hospital and he had a crush on his mother, which he obviously kept hidden. But without his inhibitions, obviously some inappropriate behaviour was going on in the home and they had to move him into a special place with special people who have brain injuries. So without your sense of inhibition, that's not... I guess what we're not showing people is our real selves. You're right. I take it back. You're right. But what our real selves is something that we don't want to really, I guess, we have parts of our brain that hides the real self and goes to social. You know, I think, and I'm going to get really complicated here. I think that when we're born, we're like a computer and we take in our surroundings and we adapt to it. And if we're born with wolves, we adapt to wolves and we become dogs if we're raised by wolves at a tender age of about 0 to 3 years old. That programming is your surrounding and you can't break free of that. You can't make a child that's been raised by wolves become a human. They're a wolf. So we're a life form that's just completely adaptive and we come into the life and our brains tell us this is what customary behavior is, this is what is acceptable, this is what you hide, this is what you don't hide, and you continue to learn that throughout. So the real self, the real us, without our inhibitions and without the brain, heaven knows what that is.
And I think we're bringing stuff into it too. I think we may be bringing in stuff from past lives, baggage, and who knows what that we're dealing with in this life as well. And when you know, and one thing I learned is that when you leave this life and transition, spirits are still, they're still asleep. They can still be pretty angry and guilt-ridden and sexually perverse or whatever, believe it or not. I didn't know that. I thought when you left and you died, you know, you'd look back and say, oh, life was nothing and it was joke and I feel great and I don't care about any of that anymore. I'm a spirit now. I'm in the spirit world and it doesn't matter. But in fact, I've learned differently. So, I mean, I've taken 3 years of mediumship training with the Spiritualist Church in Florida. So
you think that you continue to learn after you die?
I do. Yeah. I think you learn after you die and there's pre-life planning that comes into this as well. And so it's all very complex. We're multidimensional beings and We have very complex personalities.
Yes, so. The part that we're in, our physical body, is just the tip of the iceberg, really.
Yeah, it really is.
So when I was dead, I didn't have any biofeedback. So I think about my family, and once I realized I was dead, and the emotions that come after a thought, the reaction your body gives you, that part isn't there. It's just.
Sorry, Jax, did you say that you realized you were dead? You were conscious of being dead?
Well, yeah, but here's the thing. Don't want to run you through what happened.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. It's kind of weird. It's like no other story. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure I probably told you at some stage, but we yak on about so many things. We probably anyway. I didn't. It was like the accident didn't happen, and it was like waking up, okay, and going through the process of when you wake up in the morning, the first thing you do is remember everything. Your brain recalls stuff. So it's just like a computer. When you boot it on, the first thing it does is remember, and then it goes from there. So I went through that process, and as I was going through that process, I could see a blackness, like a narrow field of vision in front of me, and three stars that weren't glistening. They were just still. And I was going through this process of, you know, I didn't quite know where I was and it didn't really matter. And then I saw the planet Jupiter come up from underneath me and just go, boom, underneath. And that's when I realized I think I'm dead. Wow. But it was more like F-U-C-K, I'm dead. And I tried to think of what the F-U-C-K happened. How did I get out here? And what's going to happen now kind of thing didn't really enter my mind. But and I had a vision of my family looking over me, either from the hospital bed or on the street. I had no idea. But the place where I thought that was very close to the place where the accident happened. And I didn't have any idea of the accident at this stage. But I knew I was in Chatswood and I was on a gutter looking up and the family looking down. And I didn't get any biofeedback then. I knew, I was aware that it was a sad thing and that I'd like to be with my family. But I didn't need it emotionally. I didn't have the physical, emotional need that comes with those kind of feelings. I saw Jupiter a second time, so I take it I was probably in an orbit of some sort. And,
wow.
You seem to like Jupiter.
Huh?
You seem to like Jupiter.
Oh, well, I'm a Cancer and that's my planet. Now, the medium who I speak to is this absolutely amazing woman. She is... unlike most people, she's extraordinary, very extraordinary, very talented, born with her gift, has been studying her whole life. And she said that what I went through is a process that we go through in our, because the space out there in space, that's where our mind is. When you look at this planet, you're looking at your mind, the thing that goes through the radio. Okay. Wow. And I was still connected. I wasn't technically dead. There's a cord and I was still connected and I did a loop around the Jupiter and I came back again, and had that cord snapped, I would have gone through to the next, dimensional, what have you.
Transition of some sort.
Yes. And when you do, apparently when you die, according to her, a door opens. She creates these doors. She can open them, when she got rid of the poltergeist for me that I had. Yes. And you walk through the door. That hasn't happened to me as such. I had the Jupiter thing happen. But the funny thing is I didn't, when I was floating through space and for all I knew I could be there for all eternity, it didn't occur to me to pray or say anything of any religious at all. It was, am I going to become the electricity that runs someone's television now? What are we doing on Earth with all these we don't even know what electricity is. What's going to come of me now? Is this consciousness of mine just going to float through these awful, you know, they're not, because there is another dimension. But I didn't think to ask God for anything. And you can ask, I don't mean to get all preachy on you, but.
Not at all.
It's just funny that if I was in that situation, the dark situation where I thought that it could have been, it wouldn't have occurred to me, because I didn't have any idea of spirituality back then or anything of that nature. Which is silly.
Well, I think where I am, you know, and with this, because this is one of my favorite topics, the afterlife or life after life. It's very interesting.
Absolutely. Yeah. Amazing. Can I ask you, Jax, Your unusual way of your unusual amazing abilities and
Perspectives.
and I guess the clairvoyancy. Do you think that was associated with having the near-death experience? Do you think it opened you up?
My spirituality.
Spirituality and your gift?
Oh, partly. It mostly frightened me at first. It frightened me, which is why I turned to the mathematics and wanted to learn more about what was going on. But it did. I guess it was a process I went through because I needed help. I really needed more help than what the doctors could give me. And that's when I found the medium who was able to help me. And no one else could. So I knew that there must be something in that. When it comes to life after death, I wasn't 100% convinced until I had the poltergeist. That's when I went, right, there's so something else. There is somewhere that we go. These people didn't quite make it through the door. They're stuck. But there is a door, and I know that for sure. And I feel very comfortable having experienced that for myself. If anyone had told me, I wouldn't have believed them. You need to experience firsthand to be
Yes.
sure and
So
to
did you have
know.
a pretty hairy experience with a poltergeist?
Yes, and I lived by myself at the time, and all I had was my cat. She was a good cat.
Wow.
I had faces looking through the window at me. I was groped many times. I had
Oh my
furniture
God.
moving. I had ter terrible nightmares, dark shadows walking around my room, dark shadows above my head, the whole thing. Yeah.
Wow.
You know what's really interesting about this, from my point of view, is I've had out-of-body experiences, of course. I've talked about them, and I once saw the proverbial dark cloud. That was one of my first major experiences with being out of body, and it was frightening. But in saying that, a lot of these experiences were frightening. Over time, I came to understand their nature. And what I got out of that is, even though these were scary experiences, it opened up my mind to the realization that there's something more to life. There's another side. I'm not
So did you do
seeing
this
everything.
intentionally, or did you accidentally do an out of body?
Well, it was there, and I was sort of made aware of it, and it was a spontaneous astral projection.
Can you do
So,
it deliberately?
no, I mean, I haven't really spent the time to really work on that. I think I'd like to attend the Monroe Institute
Oh
at
my
some
God, yes,
point.
you can learn how to do it at the Monroe
One
Institute.
of my, I'd like to spend more time on that,
I don't know
but
much about that. I mean, do you really leave your body?
you do, yeah. I had a very cla I've had two or three classic out of body experiences where I've seen myself standing in my room, in my living room or bedroom, sleeping, and I've seen strange creatures, and
Oh,
you know,
wow.
it's very, very clear. And it's very difficult to validate scientifically what that is, if it's
Actually,
anything,
I've had
because
that once. I've had that once. Yes. I know. I
yeah,
know.
and
Yeah,
you can't
that is
prove
true.
anything. I mean, you know, people just say it's a hallucination of the mind or some kind of dream state or trance state, or
They
but
can
that doesn't
prove.
explain anything.
Well, when it is a hallucination of the mind, such as the bright light that people have talked about when they've been near death, that was proven to be natural ketamine. So when it is, they can prove when it's a hallucination. I
How
think.
do you know that that natural ketamine or whatever it is isn't God? I mean,
What is a
Good
hallucination?
point, Lana. Good point. Good point. Because it's a it could be. It could be. You're right. There you go.
This is mind body and spirit. It all works together. So, I mean,
Yeah, it
even if it
does.
is chemicals and organic, it can still be very spiritual.
Fascinating stuff. Absolutely fascinating. Wow.
It is. It is.
How much time have we got left? We might have to
About 15 minutes.
15 minutes.
Yeah.
Fifteen, did you say?
Believe so.
Okay.
All right. Well, why
Well,
don't we take a.
I wonder whether Jackson can tell us a little bit about your clairvoyant, your animal whispering sort of capabilities, because we love animals,
I
and
certainly do.
I'd love to be able to talk to them.
Okay, well, some of them, I'll teach you how. I'll teach you how. It's really easy. I was given a book for Christmas that basically written by a deaf woman who could talk to animals all her life, and she thought everyone else could until she realized at the age of 20 or so that it was a gift she had. She wrote this book, I read it, and it just instructs you how to do it. It's quite easy. You can talk to any animal at any time if they'll talk to you. Some animals I can't talk to, some I can talk to really clearly. My sister's horse I can talk to very clearly. One of your animals I can talk to pretty clearly. The one that
Really?
was not
Which one
very
of our
well.
animals can you talk to?
The one that was sits at the fridge and
Figgy.
meows. The one with the
Oh, our Burmese cat?
who complains all the time.
Yeah, she showed me the fruit.
Oh, can you tell, what is it that he complains about?
His tummy. He's sick. He doesn't, I mean, he showed me a pile of vomit, and even though I know he's hungry and he wants to eat all the time, his food's not getting through to him. It's as if it's not, he's not getting something. Something's wrong there. But I don't think he feels sick. But he showed me, you know, I asked him, what did you have for dinner last night? And I got a pile of vomit as an answer. Sometimes they joke with you. Sometimes they joke.
Well, he is going for an operation soon to get his teeth removed. I mean, he has had some gum infections and he's taking antibiotics. So that's probably part of it, I'm sure.
Jackie, when you try to talk to animals, is there, I mean, the verbal, their processing abilities?
Oh, well, no, here's the thing. It's the same as what a psychic does. You use your intuition, and what you get is not a voice in your head, but it's a feeling that's really very clear. It's clearer than if someone was yelling it down your ear. And you get pictures as well, especially with animals talk a lot in pictures.
What about the sophistication of it? I mean, do you have to, you know, does it have to be down to a very simple level? Or, I mean, you can't really ask the meaning of life for them, can you?
You can ask anything you want in English and you'll get the answer back in English. But what they hear is their own language. And that,
telepathic.
But it comes back really well and very clear.
Wow. Look, you know, we've got 2 minutes left. So, you know, maybe we're going to have you back again.
It's fascinating.
Such a fascinating call. I'd love to be able to talk to my animals.
Yeah, you have so much to say. Thank you so much for being on the show.
I'll go through the whole process with you and we'll do it.
Yeah, we'll do that sometime. Okay, well, thank you. Thank you so much for being on the show, Jackie. Very much appreciated.
I'm sure our listeners have been suitably stimulated and by all the discussion. And it's
good
interesting to think about all these people's brains wired into this show, and it's sort of all really one stream of consciousness.
It really is. Okay, well.
Okay, thanks. I'll see you around.
Okay.
Thanks, Jackie.
And it's a goodbye from us.
At Universal Soul Lab. We'll see you next time. Take care. Bye.